welcome listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our communities and the health of our society, and the health of planet Earth. Each week on the show, I talk to different experts, authors, advocates, scientists, thought leaders, foodies, and others about the state of our health and well-being and all the different facets of our world that impact it. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the election with two different guests, one in each half hour of the show. I call it the Connect the Dots Election Uproar 1, because this is our first show like this, and I probably will be doing many more throughout this very different and exciting and in some ways not so different and not so, you know, and rather dreadful election season. So we'll be launching that today with two fantastic guests. In our first half hour, I'll be talking with Arun Gupta. He's an investigative reporter who contributes to Yes Magazine, The Nation, Telesur, The Progressive, and The Washington Post. He's a graduate of the French Culinary Institute here in New York City and the author of the upcoming book, Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction. I can't but laugh. It's an adorable title. A Junk Food-Loving Chef's Inquiry into Taste. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Arun Gupta.
Thank you for having me on.
I'm delighted to have you. You know, given your background, people might, unless they had read your articles and knew that you were co-founding editor of The Independent and part of Occupy Wall Street, they might not understand what they're in for in this half hour of the show, but let them quickly find out. We're going to be talking, we're going to be talking here about this election season. And actually, you know, maybe I'll just begin by asking you, Arun, in what way is this season, which I think many people are experiencing as white-knuckling different than prior elections, the same old, and new and different than what we've seen before in terms of both the candidates and the election process and what its likely outcomes will be according to your perspective?
Well, you know, the easy answer is how this is different is Donald Trump. No one has ever seen anything like this before. You've had fringe candidates run before, but you've never had one win the nomination. Technically, he hasn't won, but it's pretty much assured he will be the Republican presidential nominee, this self-promoting, blowhard, narcissistic billionaire. Is now going to run for president and may in fact win. But what really tends to be the same is that you have basically two rather despised candidates. In fact, historically despised. There are probably no more hated people in the country than Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And the policy-wise, I mean, this is also, you know, not surprisingly, the Democrat is really pushing a lot of Republican policies. And in recent decades, really beginning with Bill Clinton, what you find is you have two Republicans running. But once again, Donald Trump is making it rather interesting because he's actually, he has some, you know, just unbelievably heinous ideas and policies. The man is an outright racist. And, you know, pretty much anyone who supports him is, you know, if you want to deport 11 million immigrants or if you want to have a ban on Muslims. But in many other ways, he's going to be running to the left of Hillary Clinton. So this is just utterly bizarre. She is, you know, a complete hawk, a warmonger. Trump is promoting an America first policy, in other words, kind of a neo-isolationism. On economic issues, he's all over the place. He is against free trade deals, whereas Clinton, of course, Hillary Clinton was one of the chief strategic advisors in the White House in the 90s when Bill Clinton pushed through the NAFTA, and then she supported TPP as Secretary of State. So she's been an architect of these horrendous trade deals over the last 20 years, and Donald Trump very much opposes them. And now he's even come out for an increase in the minimum wage and kind of increasing taxes on the wealthy. It's often very hard to read exactly what he means. But essentially, you have a Republican now who is running in some ways to the left of a Democrat, and a Democrat who is in many ways an orthodox Republican. So it's a rather bizarre election.
That's a really strange point. You know, I just want to interject here because on this program, there, you know, I probably had 20 plus programs of Connect the Dots on the trade deals. And I actually regard the trade deals as one of the primary election issues. I know a lot of people are kind of like, it's about, you know, the Supreme Court, or it's about keeping, you know, and advancing rather than regressing on women's rights. You know, these are other kind of sort of top of the pile issues, money in politics. You know, if we can't get the monies out of politics and people are buying the elections and the elected officials, you know, then we really have no handle on government or pretense of being a democracy. You know, Clinton has nominally said that, you know, where do you place, I guess I would like to ask, the trade deals in terms of, you know, what would you place as the top defining issue, you know, the top issues of what this election is about? You know, is it about we either vote for anyone or we're going to have stormtroopers running down Fifth Avenue? Is it about, you know, like what would be, you know, is it about, oh, if we don't, you know, if we can't be there with someone who's going to put in some middle of the road justices, you know, we're done? I mean, what would you regard as maybe the top 3 to 5, you know, election issues that are really, whether they're prominent or not, you know, that really are the key deciding points in this election? So that people kind of, you know, there's so much personality. I think people don't know what they're getting under the package so well. I think many people don't know what you just said, which is, you know, Hillary has been a long-term proponent. They'd look at her nominal recent, like, oh, I could tweak them and, you know, kind of think, oh, well, she's not in favor of them just because she said so this year. I mean, what would you regard as the primordial things being decided by this election, whether we have a say in it or not, really?
Well, I don't think, you know, we'll see stormtroopers down Fifth Avenue, mainly because Donald Trump, it's going to be extremely difficult for him to get elected. This isn't a matter of the Republican nomination. The pundits weren't even listening to their own polls. That was the whole thing. Donald mm-hmm. Trump led in something like over 80% of over 500 polls done. He was always pretty much the leader. And so the pundits weren't looking at their own polling data. For the general election, it's reverse. He's behind in like 90%, and it's still early. But the groups that he needs to appeal to, you know, women, minorities, youth, all just, it's phenomenal his how strongly people despise him. But, you know, having just seen him Friday night, I can tell you if there were going to be stormtroopers, he'd be like, we're going to have the classiest stormtroopers, believe you me. They're going to be so classy. You'll never have seen anything like this. I mean, the guy's a showman, you know, that's the thing. But in terms of issues, the issue that we're not talking, there is only one issue: climate change. Okay, I am not an apocalyptarian. I'm not someone who believes that the world is going to end tomorrow. Humanity will muddle on, whatever happens for a long time to come. But we are talking about we're in the middle of this sixth great extinction in Earth's history. We are fundamentally, we're not just altering the biology of the planet. Humans are such a profound impact. We're actually altering the geology of the planet. We're even altering the evolution of the planet. There are scientists who talk about this is only the third evolutionary phase in the entire Earth's history, and humans have set it into motion. So it's getting zero attention whatsoever. And what we're looking at is going to be absolutely devastating. The problem is the timescale for these things are in the decades and centuries. So it's really impossible in our political system to make it about climate change unless it's already a disaster. Otherwise, you know, I think, yes, the trade deals, but kind of a global economic policy. But again, this is something that all ties in into, I think, the climate change. And, you know, one of the things I try and explain to people is also it's not just climate change. There are about 8 or 9 interrelated ecological crises, right? There's deforestation. There's a death of the oceans and coral reefs. There's habitat loss, xenospecies, that's invasive species, the sixth great extinction, the nitrogen and phosphorus cycle. So there's all these interrelated crises. And when you're talking about political issues, geopolitical, geoeconomic issues, these all involve these ecological issues. Because if you don't address the maldistribution of goods, if you don't address conflicts arising over habitation, over space, over resources, you're not going to be able to address these ecological crises, which is then going to make the political and economic crises work. So something like TPP, if it is passed, is going to be a disaster on many levels. It'll be a disaster for humanity and for the planet.
And yet, along with Sanders, it's kind of been in a media blackout, pretty much, with the, you know, the kind of alternative media and various other kinds of media being the sole ones to address it. So, I mean, actually, I have to just, you know, basically be frank that this, I agree with you, and my prince, I mean, anyone who's a foodie or cares about health could be terrified by the TPP, but the, you know, but the primary overreaching concern is indeed the environment, as you so brilliantly articulated it, and I share your view entirely. So, in fact, I mean, in Trump, we have a candidate who putatively is against this, and Sanders opposes it. So, actually, the candidate that we're running to as our savior is Secretary Clinton, the Democratic candidate, who, you know, on at one side of her mouth says, oh, yes, I care about climate change and I'll follow the Paris, you know, agreement to, you know, down that slow winding road to stalling fossil fuel development. And yet on the other side, she's, you know, taking money from those companies. And she's declaring that her husband she would like to instate as the czar of trade, you know, to oversee the trade deals.
Oh, I mean, Bill Clinton is the absolute worst. I mean, people have this, I think, this rose-colored view of the 1990s for, you know, one, it was after the Cold War ended. It was before September 11th. And you also had this economic boom, which was actually a bubble. It was the huge stock market internet bubble. And so I think a lot of people really feel like, oh, somehow we're going to go back to this era of, you know, you can't call it prosperity because the income inequality was growing dramatically during the Clinton era. But it certainly was better for many people than it has been in a long time, really, in the last 15 years. But, you know, here's kind of, I think, the simplest way to explain the differences between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Donald Trump will, the thing is, his policies will, if he even tried to implement them, such as putting tariffs on goods from China or starting these different trade wars, or, you know, it's now also, it's hard to go back and start to tear up deals like NAFTA, because the way that the U.S. is not isolated from the rest of the world. The economy is so integrated into the world that he would probably cause a severe recession inside the United States. And then if he even tried to deport 11 million people, you would see just severe, even, you know, just from people's own self-interest, this would severely impact agriculture, construction, restaurant, and hospitality industries. Because that's where, you know, we need to stop also, I think, talking about immigration. These are workers. This is a labor issue. When you hear people talk about illegal aliens, it's like, no, this is actually a labor issue, and that's the way it needs to be reframed. They're coming here for jobs. There's a small number of people who are coming here seeking asylum, but they're also looking for work when they come here. So this is very much more a labor issue. But so the simple way to put it is Donald Trump will be worse for workers and brown people inside the United States. Hillary Clinton will be worse for workers and brown people outside of the United States.
Why do you say, what, explain, I can understand the Trump part of it, given the trade deals, but what, explain the Clinton part of it. How will she be worse for brown people and better, for, will she be better for white people or just not as bad?
Not as bad.
Mm-hmm.
So simply trade deals, that's, who's that going to affect? It'll affect U.S. workers. But it'll be much worse for workers internationally in
mm-hmm.
all these countries that have just, you know, sweatshop economies throughout
mm-hmm.
Asia and the Pacific Rim countries.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, I mean, she is a warmonger. I think that's kind
mm-hmm.
of the best objective term to use from her. She hasn't... found a conflict that she doesn't think can't be solved through bombing. You know, she was a proponent of the Iraq War. You know, folks, especially younger folks, probably don't know this or remember this at all, but the Clintons bring the Taliban to power in Afghanistan in the late 90s with the help of the Saudi and Pakistani intelligence services. Because it would bring stability to Afghanistan. You know, she was the key proponent of the Libyan war, which was an utter disaster. She was pushing for war against Iran. You know, she was involved in the coup in Honduras. She just thinks like there isn't any problem that can't be solved by bombs. And frankly, you know, the utter cynicism with which she tries to promote feminism, I think is it's just, and you know, these are strong words, but it's just really repulsive. I mean, this is a woman who bombs brown women in the third world. The Clintons oversaw the dramatic rise of the mass incarceration state. And during the 90s, that's when you saw the dramatic rise in the imprisonment of African-American women. They pushed through the gutting of welfare, which threw over 2 million women and children off the welfare rolls, just, you know, absolutely devastating to so many people. And I travel around the country, and I tell you that just the social devastation that I see in American cities, you know, there's so much wealth, but there's just so much immiseration and poverty cheek by jowl beside that wealth.
Why do some people consider her a feminist? I mean, that's, you know, given, is it just complete ignorance of her record, do you think? Is it white privilege? What is it?
We live in a very image conscious society, you know, and so we,
mm-hmm.
we start to believe that image actually trumps reality. I mean, you know, we could get into the, like, you know, the French theory, the, you know, in terms of I think some of this has to do with how people have misused Michel Foucault's theory in terms of text mattering more than action. But that's what we have with Hillary Clinton. She's the image of feminism. This is the, you know, the woman who was a second wave feminist and has always been, you know, she was a corporate lawyer and a mother. Of course, she was on the board of Walmart as well, which had this massive sex discrimination lawsuit against them that the Scalia Supreme Court threw out on a technicality. But her record is horrendous. You know, the deportations that have been going on, and, you know, this is just absolutely destroying families. Like, you know, when I talk to immigrants who've been deported or whose families, you know, when some of them end up deported and others stay in the U.S., you know, you're taking away
mm-hmm.
breadwinners, you're taking away parents. This was the Clinton era Immigration Reform Act, you know, and of course the Clintons were also responsible for the Telecommunications Act, which, you know, gave rise, they were helped give rise to Fox News, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which set the groundwork for the financial crisis, for the subprime bubble. I mean, they were utterly disastrous. And I think that is part of the reason she is so despised, that people do have an awareness of that, a lot of the really heinous stuff that is going down. But she's also a terrible politician. So she doesn't have just that savvy, that natural instinct that Bill Clinton has. She's a very smart woman. She's very ambitious, but she doesn't have that politician's presence in the way that others do.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, as someone who is doing, you know, phone banking and all of that kind of thing, there are just, you know, an extraordinary number of women of color, you know, who, I mean, oddly, and I don't know what the explanation of this is, but the very people or some of the very people that she disenfranchises most look on her as their representative in the system that will speak up for them. And I'm speaking of women of color, I mean, you know, how, as well as maybe uneducated or uninformed middle-class women, you know, who are like, you know, didn't bother to follow someone's record, you know, don't really read up on that and just have a very superficial grasp of anything, believe what, you know, Bloomberg or CNN or NPR has to tell them. But why the women of color, you know, it's almost like, they see her, the same fighting spirit that makes her a militarist, right, and a warmonger, mm-hmm. Also seems to make her seem, in some people's hopeful eyes, as a warrior for their protection, when in fact she's undermining them.
Well, so there was an article just a couple of days ago in the New York Times. Folks are familiar now with, I think, the data that came out last year about that middle-age working-class whites are seeing a decline in life expectancy, which is absolutely astonishing. You know, to see a decline in life expectancy in an industrialized nation is almost unheard of outside mm-hmm. of warfare. The first time this ever happened was in Russia during the 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now among this population, which is not insignificant, you know, middle class, working class whites is probably a few tens of millions, their life expectancy is declining. The thing is, during the 90s, African American life expectancy started to rise again. Starting in the 1980s, it started to stagnate. Of course, why did it start to stagnate? Because you had the Reagan administration, which took a chainsaw to social welfare and combined with the deindustrialization that went on during the 80s. So these were very, and the also the war on drugs. So these were very hard times for the African-American community. During the 1990s, the Clintons were very good managers of trickle-down economics. That's what I try to get people to understand, that what the Clintons really did was they fulfilled the Reagan Revolution. And that's what the Democrats basically and left parties throughout the world in major countries, whether it's Brazil or England or France. In France right now, you have the socialists are trying to gut these historic labor laws that really protect the workforce from becoming precarious, and as in what's happening in the U.S. And it's being done by the socialists. And incidentally, you also have an Occupy Wall Street type movement that has risen up there. But the left parties, and you know, they're only left in name, basically sell themselves as we are better managers of neoliberal trickle-down economics. And there is a truth to there is a truth to that. So I think, you know, we have to, like, I never like explanations where people are like, oh, they're, you know, like the white working class, they're being duped, or, you know, women of color are being duped. We have to also mm-hmm. see it from, really try to see it as much as possible from their perspective. And during the 90s, the economy was booming. It was a lot of minimum wage, low wage jobs, but anyone who wanted to get work could get work. And by the mm-hmm. late 90s, it was becoming so hard for corporations to find work that they were actively, you know, going into like low income communities. They were starting jobs programs for folks who were released from prison, because there was just such a dearth of labor available. And then you have the subprime mortgage crisis that starts a few years after that. For the African American community, it started around 2003, 2004. And then over the next decade, you saw the biggest destruction of black wealth in U.S. history. And much of that, you know, it started under Bush, but much of it continued under Obama. So I think people are nostalgic for this period because things seem better, and also because she's a strong woman who's had to put up with a lot of abuse in the public sphere, and she's had to put up with, you know, a philandering pig named Bill Clinton. You know, but we should also remind ourselves, we shouldn't forget that there is very credible evidence that Hillary Clinton engaged in trying to destroy the women that Bill Clinton abused, because she saw that as a threat to their joint political career. There's Carl Bernstein, in his book, you know, and his stuff is, you know, exhaustively researched, includes accounts of Hillary Clinton trying to destroy these women personally because they were threatening Bill Clinton's and her political career both. She's a faux feminist. She is not a feminist in any sense of the word.
Well, that's a brilliant and complete analysis. And I know we're coming to the end of our time here. I feel you're amazing, and I hope you'll accept an invitation to come back to the show and speak periodically, because your analysis is absolutely brilliant. And I think you know, part of the whole thing that goes on with the media is, you know, there's an exclusion of a certain kind of conversation, and then also there's a kind of dullness of a certain kind of conversation. And your analysis is both very thorough and very provocative. So I just want to thank you for being on the show today, Arun. We're speaking with Arun Gupta today here on Connect the Dots. How do people connect with your writing? Should they go to Yes Magazine? You know, how do they find and follow you? And I also want to mention that you're going to be at the Left Forum, which is coming up in New York on May 21st mm-hmm. and 22nd, that weekend. You're going to be presenting a panel on Sunday on what we can learn from populism and the Tea Party. People can go to leftforum.org in order to sign on and come to that weekend. I'm also presenting there on Saturday in a panel on Fukushima on the Hudson, a topic that I've covered on this show a great deal, the gas pipeline mm-hmm. through the nuclear power plant north of New York City. So how do they connect with your writings, Arun, and, you know, follow what you're doing? They can follow you on Twitter at Arun K. Gupta. Is that right?
Arun Indy, at Arun, A-R-U-N-I-N-D-Y. And my website is arunkgupta.com. I need to, it's a reminder, I need to update it. I haven't updated it in a little while, but they can see a lot of my past writings. And then, you know, just if they Google Arun Gupta, you know, in Google News, you'll come up with my recent articles.
Mm-hmm. Terrific. And do come to Left Forum, which you can find at leftforum.org, and you know, come see Arun's panel on Sunday, and you can come see mine on Saturday. So thank you so much, Arun, for your brilliant analysis, and we're going to keep following what you're up to and hopefully bring you back again to keep commenting as the show progresses. Arun's going to be going to the Republican convention and reporting from that, so that gives you even more incentive to follow what happens and what he has to say about how that all is playing out. Thank you so much for being on Connect the Dots today, Arun.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's been great talking with you. Listeners, we're going to be continuing the show with our next guest, so stay with us, and we'll be back in just a second after station ID. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. Thanks for staying with us. If you enjoyed the first half of the show with Arun Gupta, please look for it in the Connect the Dot archives and share it with your friends. On the second half of the show, we're going to be continuing the conversation about the current political campaign and certain key issues that we'll tease out on to kind of give you a different orientation from what you may get from the mainstream media. My guest today in the second half of the show is Heidi Huttner, PhD. She's a teacher and a writer who writes about environment, environmental justice, ecofeminism, eco-criticism, film and media, and she's also the director of sustainability studies at Stony Brook University, as well as the associate dean in the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences. She's an active public speaker on environmental issues, and she also has her own internet podcast called Coffee with H Times 2, in which she discusses different facets of the environment and interviews different activists and thought leaders about different things going on in our world. So Heidi and I have been longtime sort of compadres or sisters and associates in raising awareness about the environment and coming also from a female perspective, a woman's perspective, which, you know, bringing that particular accent to our caring for the earth. And there are many of us out there, although a lot of the, you know, sort of named national thought leaders in the environment like Bill McKibben and Michael Broom of Sierra Club and Josh Fox and others are men. Actually, the movement has a lot of really dedicated women protecting the earth and, you know, big earth protectors for the sake of all of wildlife and our families, children and succeeding generations. And Heidi Huttner is certainly one of them. What we're going to be discussing during this half hour is a kind of strange quirk that Heidi and I both noticed and began kind of chatting with each other about, which is that there are so many women of the older generations primarily, and that's not to mean every woman of the older generation, because I'm certainly of the older generation, but many women are kind of, there's almost like you know, it's an either or between caring about women and women's rights and women's equity issues and caring about the environment. And somehow in the current campaign, the Democratic presidential campaign, it's been really difficult to keep both of those things in focus and in the right relationship and priority to one another. And as fierce environmentalists who are also outspoken women, you know, both Heidi Huttner and myself, we've been kind of chatting because we feel that that area needs to be kind of talked about more and understood better. And so that's what we're going to be doing in this half hour. So, Heidi, thanks for being on the show with me today.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate that introduction. It was quite thorough.
Well, I want to give everyone, and this is going to be a little different from the usual Connect the Dots half hour where I interview a guest about a book. This is going to be almost like more like a conversation between friends and colleagues, you know?
Right.
You're really identified with ecofeminism. Maybe you could you know, share a little bit with our listeners, you know, what the perspective from ecofeminism is, so that when we put ecology, environment, and feminism together, you know, what that adds up to, just to orient people who may not be aware of it.
Sure, I'm happy to explain that. So I began working on ecofeminism when I taught a course that I created called Ecofeminism Literature and Film at Stony Brook in 2004. I'm actually writing a book about that course and the journey to that course and what it involves and my personal experience through that. And so what ecofeminism is doing, and it's a philosophy, and it's a perspective that sees that there are twin oppressions. There's the oppression of women and the oppression and domination of the environment, and that they work sort of parallel to each other and in similar ways. And that oppression also applies to other non-powerful groups, so indigenous people, non-white people, the poor, groups that are in religions that are oppressed or certainly marginalized. And the way, you know, if you look historically, we look at how the environment was treated and how women were viewed, and so they were owned, possessed, objectified, and exploited for economic profit. And that sort of, I'm talking, you know, several hundred years ago. Mm-hmm. But that thinking, that ideology persists. And so we see the environment as something that we can buy, purchase, use as we want, dominate. You know, it's the argument that Rachel Carson made was that, you know, we're not superior to nature. We think we are. We think we can mold it and change it and shape it. And that's sort of the old patriarchal model. And it's the same model with women. Women were historically, you know, owned in marriage and didn't have rights over their bodies, and so we've carried that forward. The other piece that's really important about ecofeminism is that it really wants to deconstruct the idea that the world is made up in binaries or dualisms, and in that structure, which we still currently live within, someone's always more powerful than the other, and we're also pitted against each other. So if you think of male, female, or black and white, or Christian, non-Christian. And in that model, and you can kind of just go down the list, someone's always on top. And what ecofeminism wants to take away is that sort of that power model, that someone has the right to dominate the other just because they have more power, and is looking for more equity and more, and looking at the world in a more interconnected way, and seeing themselves in connection to the environment, in connection to the non-human world. And so that's a very simplistic and basic introduction to it. And mm-hmm. It's a different model than, you know, someone has power over someone else, or, you know, you see it in government, you see it in business. It's really kind of trying to shift to a more a world of more equity.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's so interesting as I hear you describe that, because it's kind of like, you know, there's this longing that's expressed among many women after, you know, years and decades and lifetime of living in patriarchal structures and mm-hmm. struggling to survive and raise our families in them and all of the rest of it, you know, to kind of at last have a woman on top, in the sense, you know, what is still kind of on top, because that is the presidential position. You know, so then there's a sense, you know, that this will at last create the breakthrough we've all been longing for. You know, this is something that people of a certain generation, older generation, want to see in their lifetime, and it's kind of held out as like the great hope. But at the same time, recognizing what you just said, which is the perspective offered by ecofeminism, you know, the person on top, which is inevitably the person on top in a presidential primary, is also going to be occupying the same dominating seat that these patriarchal figures who've been male have occupied. And so then the question becomes, you know, if it's a woman, does that automatically mean that's going to be handled differently? And, you know, or in fact, are some of these other values, you know, what are the values in question? You know, who embodies the values of kind of engaging in community and all of that, or, you know, some of the other ecofeminist values more successfully? You know, so in effect, it's like it's kind of sloppy seconds, because with the coronation election or whatever of Hillary Clinton, it's like we get the person on top, but is it the person that embodies the values that ecofeminism talks about?
Right. Well, one of the things.
And where does that differ? Right. In other words, what would that look like what would an eco-feminist in a leadership role, what would be, what would that look like?
Well, and I mean, I will say this. You know, Hillary's really, really good on feminist issues and on LGBT
mm-hmm.
issues, no question. And
mm-hmm.
she will look out for women's rights. And that is part
mm-hmm.
of ecofeminism, because we want to be caring about the other 50% and thinking about them
mm-hmm.
on equal terms. And mm-hmm. there's no question that a woman will be, well, we would hope. That's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other piece, is just because you're a woman doesn't mean you're going to be a feminist. So we shouldn't assume that, right? And so that's number one. But I do think Hillary's certainly a feminist, no question. However, she's not really, if you kind of look beneath the surface, and I know you and I agree on this, she's not really an environmentalist. So that's the concern. You know, she did push fracking in Europe. You know, she talks about gas and kind of covert terms of clean, you know, a clean energy. It's not. We know it isn't. And Bill just spoke positively about the tar sands, right? The tar sands pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're seeing what's happening in Alberta with the fires there, ironically, and horribly. So the question is, you know, yes, I personally would love to see a woman as president, but then who is that woman? And does that woman embody the values of ecofeminism? I would say not, because so far, at least, she's not really showing strong support of really important environmental issues. It's not enough just to say, I'm going to pay attention to the climate. What are you going to do? You know, and if you're going to support gas and oil, then that's not going to help the climate, right? So I'd like to see, personally, a really strong argument, plan of hers on the environment that I can comment on. It's been, right now, I mean, from what we see of her past record, it's not terribly environmental. Maybe she'll change. Maybe she's will, you know, take a harder line on this. I don't know, and I don't see it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And
you
that's
know,
my concern.
Yeah, I mean, I share that concern. She's also dialed back on coal. You know,
right.
At one point she said earlier, you know, to kind of equal Bernie Sanders in a debate, she kind of,
right.
you know, was down on coal. Then she goes to West Virginia and it's back up on coal. So there's also the question of, you know, how
yeah.
deep is the environmental commitment? You
exactly.
know, if formally she was in favor of fracking, if formally she was a proponent of the trade deals, but now she's
mm-hmm.
kind of, maybe I'm not so sure they need a little tweaking. It's kind of like, you know, is this expediency during a campaign, you know, willingness to say anything, and if you're the one who hears her saying certain buzzwords and phrases, you know, is the listener, is the audience, are people well enough informed to
right.
be discerning around these issues, or rather to say, well, she said she's a champion of climate change, and they maybe don't know the different specific ways that champions of climate change, you know, addressing climate change, would be fighting for, versus just kind of saying, as she did during the, for example, the New York debate with Senator Sanders, she said, you know, I'm going to follow along in President Obama's footsteps, you know, and slowly build the Paris agreements, for example, which, you know, have just been signed, but they are non-binding and very incremental at a time that we're heading toward, you know, climate chaos if we don't really do some strong things very soon. She also is funded, you know, has received funding from both individuals and companies in the gas and oil industry.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you know, I'd like to talk about different segments of women in feminism, because my sense is that when I talk to some of my longtime friends who are not environmentalists but just kind of ordinary liberal women, you know, in various
right.
professions, in the healing professions or the helping professions, you know, they're not as dialed in to some of these, you know, kind of key areas of advocacy in the environmental domain that you and I are talking about right now. I'm curious whether you've heard this too, because it seems like with their, you know, their heart on their sleeves and their feminism on their sleeves, maybe is that older women audience really well educated to what specifically needs to be addressed to address the environment, or is it, you know, they've kind of been less on the news, you know, more in sort of those caretaking female roles, are now getting older and don't want to follow anything stressful? How well informed are they, and what do they need to know?
I don't think they're well informed enough, and mm-hmm. and I, you know, it's hard to say whether if they knew more, if they really understand some of the coded language and what fracking, and also the real impact of fracking. I mean, it's been mm-hmm. you know, it's been hidden for so long, and it's only now information's coming out. You know, what's actually in fracking waste? What are the companies injecting into the earth? What are the chemicals? All these sort of secrets. There's just so much, you know, buried kind of information that the general public doesn't know. And I can understand from their perspective where they came out of a generation where the things that younger women now have, you know, better equity in job, in pay, more access to education, more access to different kinds of jobs, education, really everything. I mean, look at the medical field, even though there's a glass ceiling on sort of high-level surgery work as doctors, as you know, as many, I forget what the statistics are, but very, very high. I think there are half women or more in medical school today. I don't have the numbers in front of me, are women. So there's radical changes. And mm-hmm. and I think they want to see that continued. And we're looking at the issues also with abortion and that trying to roll all that back. I mean, it's not, we don't want mm-hmm. to forget that those are important, and what happens in the next few years in terms of women's rights and their bodies is key. And I think mm-hmm. I understand their position. They feel like Hillary's really important to that, and I agree with them. Mm-hmm. Where I don't agree, and I know you and I are in the same place, we're sort of counting the numbers and what's happening with carbon emissions, and in my work and my study of the amount of pollution all around us, and that 1 in 2 men will have cancer in their lifetimes, and 1 in 3 women, and that's just, it's just shocking. So for me, I'm also concerned about all kinds of pollution, not just, you know, carbon. Yes, I'm worried about air pollution from oil and gas, but I'm also, which is connected to all the other chemicals. But I'm worried about all the other chemicals and all the contamination and Superfund sites and water rights. And look at Flint. I mean, and Flint is one of many, many, many locations.
Mm-hmm.
And where I live on Long Island, 254 Superfund sites and, you know, thousands of chemical spills.
Wow.
Will this stop, you know, and will this be cleaned up? And can we change, you know, legislation and regulations, and all these issues are huge for me. They loom large because it's what I'm studying. So for me, as a woman, I look at anyone, any candidate who is fighting for the environment that I know of is also aware of gender equity, and it's not like it's one or the other. Whereas
mm-hmm.
in her case, from what I understand, mm-hmm. now maybe she will be different once she is, you know, assuming should she win the presidency, maybe she would be different. But her record does not show, in my mind, a strong enough, you know, strong enough on the environment. And I would love it if she were. I mean, there are other ways in which, you know, I do agree with her. Some of the, you know, and then war is another issue we haven't really talked about, but it needs to be
mm-hmm.
because, you know, weaponry is a significant. It's war brings terrible pollution. Look what's going on in the Middle East in terms of what's left behind. You know, the damage that's done environmentally and otherwise. Obviously, war in general is horrible, but it's also, you know, terrible, terrible, terrible pollution.
Mm-hmm.
Long term issues of leaving behind radiation and you know. Children who are deformed and high rates of, you know, early childhood health issues related to what's left behind. So, yeah.
And also,
I mean,
interject that it's not really,
yeah.
You know, going to war as a way of solving problems, you know, is not really, you know, very much of the feminist solution.
No.
You know, I suppose, you know, there's something about it that is traditionally male, traditionally patriarchal. Now, of course, we have women in the armed forces.
Military,
and,
right.
You know, yeah, but this military solutions, I mean, these are not... You know, it's one thing to have equity, to be any kind of, you know, person of any gender with all the rights, you know, that accrue to our country and everything like that, you know, that everyone else gets for themselves and their partners. But another facet of it is, you know, understandings and wisdom that come from, you know, the experience of being female and, you know, the bodily experience of bearing children, the roles that women traditionally fulfill, you know, and how they have acculturated women as opposed to men. So, you know, war in any form, military solutions are really the antithesis to what one might call, you know, feminine wisdom. That's not legislating that everybody born as a woman or, you know, everybody at all has
right.
to share that.
Right.
But it is certainly not a reflection of those values.
No, it's not. I mean, it's back to the old power over model, right? I'm going to go
right.
ahead and ram my idea across your country and try and push it onto you in a forceful way. No, I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's an ecofeminist model is much more about peaceful collaboration, right, and
mm-hmm.
consensus building and that sort of thing, which is not
mm-hmm.
not a traditional military model. So
mm-hmm.
no. It's an interesting question, you know, why I have a cousin who's, you know, a feminist writer and pretty well-known screenwriter, and she's a big Hillary supporter, and for her, feminism comes up number one, and she really wants to see a woman in the White House. And we, you know, we talk about this, and she actually just sent me an email and sent me a most recent statement about Hillary's position, and I kind of went through it, and I said, this is kind of coded language.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, you know, there's another quote of hers from the League of Women Voters. I'm trying to remember when that was. I think it was maybe a year ago. And it was, you know, the old, I believe she said in that where she was quoted as saying, you know, that the whole we need natural gas as a bridge fuel. And that's just, it's not true. We don't. And that sort of says, well, we'll do it for a while, but what, you know, what climate scientists are telling us is we don't have a while. You know, we don't have that kind of time anymore. And,
yeah, and that's not, I'll just interject something there here too, because it's like, A, we don't have the time, and B, you know, this sort of, you know, bridge to the future, we'll do it for a while or whatever.
Right.
Basically, that ignores the fact that it's, you know, it's going to take billions of dollars in investment over many years to create that bridge, to build it out. And so
right.
If you try to get into discussions and educate people about the clean energy options, which scientists like Mark Jacobson of Stanford have shown really could be put into play in states throughout the U.S. and really change our energy economy in a way that was both very productive for the economy and that would really, you know, eliminate the need for the use of these fossil fuels. If you're busy investing instead of you know, this gas bridge to the future, then you're not investing in those solutions. And then and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy with people saying,
right.
oh, well, it can't be done and we're not there yet. We're not there yet because that's not what
exactly.
we're investing in. So if you're building a bridge to the future, you're building the wrong bridge to the wrong filter future. And the other thing that really ticks me personally about that particular phrase is that it's a long-standing gas industry talking
right.
point.
Yeah.
And, you know, you and I have been countering that talking point back when everyone was saying that and believed it, you know, 7 or 8 years ago. Here you
right.
have a current candidate using an old talking point that has been, you know, that's basically been discarded. No one ever uses it anymore. So, you know, and so it's actually regressive. And, you know, with the rise of fracktivism, with New York's, you know, fracking ban, with the ban on the KXL, with all of these environmental achievements, there's suddenly the sense that while giving lip service to climate, you know, addressing climate change, Clinton is turning back the dial, turning back the clock, you know, by using an old gas industry term.
To be fair, it might have been 2 years ago that she said it, and I, you know, just to be, I have
no. She said it during a debate. She just said it this
oh,
year.
Oh, there
in a
you
debate.
Go. Okay, yeah. I thought she
mm-hmm.
did, but I just want to be sure. No, so,
mm-hmm.
but here's another. To be on the, you know, I can be a little bit of a Pollyanna. I try to be positive,
good.
You know, because there's
good,
so
good.
Much darkness, right? So here's the other side of the coin. Let's assume
mm-hmm.
she is going to be our candidate and for the Democratic
mm-hmm.
Party, and for those I am a Democrat. So let's say for those
mm-hmm.
of us who are Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you put the ideas, they're there to represent us. So we
mm-hmm.
have to very, very clearly and strongly articulate what we believe. And, you know, obviously there'll be people who maybe want natural gas and who are Democrats, so I can't speak for them. But so I think what needs to be really, people need to, and I'm a really strong proponent of this, people need to be active citizens. So
mm-hmm.
if she hears it enough that this is really what the people want, maybe, you know, the hope is that she will listen and will advocate and support that. I certainly don't know for sure that she would, but certainly won't happen if we don't speak up. So I think it's the other piece is, you know, okay, so this, let's assume she maybe our candidate. I know people are still out there. There are some people campaigning for Bernie or whatever, but we really have to be active and get in there and make our voices heard and be educated. That's the other thing I tell my students all the time is, you know, don't just take my word for it. You know, if you're a listener right now and you're hearing bridge fuel and does natural gas contribute to climate change? Is it worse? Is it better than oil? Are there other options? Who's Mark Jacobson? Go do your research. And if you then agree with what the positions that we're articulating, make them known to the candidate. I mean, and really forcefully articulate what you want from them. They're paid by us. So that's just my pitch to really make it clear to her that enough people want it. And
well, I think that's a great pitch, and I also think it's important to educate your friends, you know, like find out, and then, you know, through social media, or if you're, you know, someone who isn't using social media over the, you know, the meeting for coffee or whatever, educate other people, because, you know, not everybody has the same passions, not everybody knows about the same things, and if they just kind of listen to NPR and, you know, think, or just listen to mainstream media, you know, and kind of develop their thinking based on that, they could be, you know, kind of off the mark in a number of different ways. So you should listen to Connect the Dots, listen to Coffee with H Times Two, you know, and you know, read blogs and kind of inform yourself and inform
yourself.
Others. Yeah, and inform
There's
others. I think both are important. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I agree. Talking and sharing information. What on my website, HeidiHuttner.com. Which is just my name, HeidiHuttner.com. I have a place on there called Key Environmental Issues. And for each environmental issue, I summarize what the issue is very simply, and then I give links to other places to learn more. Because, you know, and I know what
That's
it's
great.
Like, if, you know, there's political issues, maybe I haven't followed it closely enough, and you open up the New York Times or whatever you're reading, and you feel like, oh, I don't know enough to really, you know, what do I do now? How do I find out more? So I actually created this with my students a few years ago, and I keep updating it and upgrading it so that anybody, you know, you don't have to be afraid to say, I don't really know what is fracking, you know, and scratch your head, and you don't want to mention to someone you don't really understand it. It will explain it to you in detail, but simply.
Yes, that's very
and
useful.
Then tell
I saw
you,
that on your
yeah.
site. That's great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And share it with your friends. I mean, that's the thing. People need to inform themselves.
Yeah,
so.
That's really important. And also, I think there's something too about the priority. You know, it's kind of you know, what is the top priority? And you know, it's hard to have something at the top priority if you don't know about it. People, you know, like the two of us who are very well informed about the environment, you know, we're very concerned. And you know, you can find out more about why we're concerned. You know, the short window that we really have to deal with climate that shortens all the time. It's not getting, you know, people used to think it was like 200 years off, then 100 years and 75 years, and now really, you know, it's getting down to decades within the lifetime of most of us, you know. So, you know, that's why there is that alarm. And so one of the things that occurs to me is like, you know, as you say, it would be great to have it all. With some candidates, maybe we can or cannot. But, you know, you don't want to have to choose between a woman's right to choice and, you know, having a viable planet for, you know, human generations to live on, right? We shouldn't be having to choose. In fact, we should have both. But I think it's, in fact, it's a necessity to have both and to fight for both. But I also think we have to know which one is the deal breaker for everything. You know,
well,
we don't want to go back to the dark ages, but we also want to assure that life survives on Earth as we have known it, you know, and so that's why we're also here to say, you know, look at, and we're kind of coming to the end of our time here, but, you know, look into that issue, inform yourself. If you're, you know, if you're already informed, share with other people and inform them. You know, like, I mean, I love on this program, we've been kind of, we see certain things in common and we don't agree about everything, but have the conversation. It's really important not to get siloed in talking only to people who agree with us on everything and in every way. So I
That's
just want to
true.
Thank you, Heidi, for, you know, joining me today on Connect the Dots, and, you know, more to be told. And look up HeidiHuttner.com and, you know, follow Heidi's podcasts. And, you know, so thank you again, listeners, for being with us for today's Connect the Dots. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. So in the coming week, till our next show, be well.